you. She's a band captain, so when the paper is covering band-related news, Octavia is often the dispatch's first call for a quote. The dark-haired dancer stalks over to a discarded streamer stick and uses it to pull in the small raft that holds several roses and lit candles.
"They are a light purple,"
Tavi says,
her voice filled with sorrow and dread. A chill runs through me. Lavender roses were Casanova's signature.
Chapter 26. Declan. The banquet hall that's hosting the post-parade VIP mixer is packed. I'm at the center of a group of teammates and coaching staff when Shane catches my eye and cocks his head for me to step away. I give a small nod and excuse myself from the group. Shane exits the illustrious group he's with, which includes the dean, a couple of professors, and the 48-year-old billionaire Drew Ralston, head of Ralston Enterprises. Ralston started his company in the basement of the GU Business School with advice and assistance from his friend, William Smith Hall, now a full professor at GU. Ralston's dark hair has thinned over the years, so he's nearly bald, but it doesn't keep him from trying to look like a hipster with his heavy black-framed glasses and beard. Smith Hall, who's trim and only about 5'8", has recently buzzed off most of his normally floppy, sandy brown hair. Apparently, he's training for a triathlon, and the buzzed hair is more practical with so much time spent in the pool. Neither Ralston nor Smith Hall were athletes as undergrads, but they're both distance runners now. Smith Hall is not a Hayworth family fan. In every class I've taken with him, he's lowballed any grade he could. The exam scores were what they were, which is what saved me, but for presentations, he consistently downgraded me to the middle of the pack, even when I knew I should have been at the top. There's apparently some bitter blood between him and Brock, and he's taking it out on me. Petty bullshit is what it is. As Shane and I meet at the buffet, I glance back at the group he just left. Avery is all smiles as she chats with the business school power brokers. What's with Avery and Smith Hall? Shane's head turns immediately to assess them. Then he shrugs. He's a mentor. He wrote the letter that got her the Ralston internship she was gunning for all last semester. Shane glances around the room. Where's your girl? Cammy? She's not my girl. I say too quickly. I don't want anyone overhearing and getting the wrong idea. Or the right one. My mind reels back to the moment during our fight when I barked at her. Completely out of character for me. And then I trapped her wrists in my hands and told her she wasn't allowed to leave. That move was unprecedented, too, and totally fucking sketchy. I don't know what came over me. Usually I have the opposite problem. I want girls to leave before they feel ready. Well, call it whatever you want, but when you send me to make house calls on a girl's family? Shane's voice drops even lower. Tell me this. Are we concerned she's not here yet? When Brock Stowe disappeared about 10 minutes ago? My gaze sharpens as I scan the room. My aunt's in a group of elite GU spouses and alumni. Several of the women fundraise full-time now. There are no men standing in that circle. My gaze swivels, checking for my uncle. Shane's right. Brock's gone. When did he leave? I didn't see him walk out, but he, Tremblay, and another DK alum had migrated toward the south doors. The next time I looked over, they were gone. Tevi Muniz hasn't been here yet, has she?
Muniz? The band girl?
I lean closer and lower my voice to a whisper. Yeah. And the girl on the ex-Fato bench.
Ah.
Shane nods. Well, maybe they've headed off to meet her in a private spot. You're right, though. With Brock's whereabouts unknown, I want Cameron here where we can watch her. My scowl deepens. She gave her security detail the slip when she went to talk to some of her friends during the parade. One second he had eyes on her, the next, she disappeared into the crowd. Shane's brows draw together. Have you texted her?
Yeah.
She's all right. She says she's making her way here, but as you see, she's not being all that quick about it. She might be trying to make a point. Shane cocks his head in question. I frown. We had a fight last night. She wanted to leave, but that didn't work out for her.
Shane's brow rises. I pretend to shrug it off as I say, it was nothing. Of course, it was not nothing. Which Shane, I'm sure, realizes. I don't know why I mention it, other than maybe to get a clearer head to suggest things are getting out of hand. Because yeah, things are getting out of hand. I can't go more than a couple of hours without wanting to have sex with her, and last night, I could not let her go, period. The dean, my aunt, and our head coach are in three separate circles, and all of them are trying to catch my eye to wave me over. If I leave right now to go after Cameron, the dean will have a stroke, I say. I swore I'd stay for at least 3 hours to give FaceTime to all the big donors. You stay. Text Cammy and find out where she is right now and which way she's walking. I'll go get her. I frown at Shane's continued use of Cameron's nickname, first, because it feels too familiar. She's not part of our inner circle, and second, because the nickname Cammy is ridiculous. It makes her sound like a seven-year-old. You'll leave Avery alone while you go out to find Cameron? I ask. Shane inclines his head. Avery will stay in this banquet hall until I get back, and you'll keep an eye on her for me. Right? Sure. I'll have my security detail keep watch, too. She won't even go to the bathroom without an escort to stand guard. Unless you think she'll balk? No. She'll behave herself. She's used to having a bodyguard. He taps his chest. Shane walks away, cutting a path to Avery, and I signal Cooper, the head of my security team, that I need a word. By the time Shane leaves the VIP area, one of my men is stationed a few feet from Avery Kershaw, and I've sent a text to Cameron, telling her I need to know exactly where she is because Shane's on his way to collect her. My little nymph keeps pushing her luck, and I keep letting her get away with it. The question is, why?
Cameron. Let's go, Aria, Eden says. Come on, don't let it ruin the night. Aria, the brunette dancer with the fierce expression, stands still, scanning the crowd. The asshole could be nearby, watching. We all look around sharply. No one appears sinister or out of place. But the hair on the back of my neck continues to stand straight up. He wouldn't stick around, Eden says. Or if this is some bullshit Casanova fan club thing, they wouldn't. Casanova fan club? Tavi squawks, looking like she swallowed a toad. Yes, I told you about the Lambda Delta party, Eden says. Aria's expression turns even darker. Assholes. And yes, they would stick around if they thought they could do it without getting caught. In this crowd, someone could hide in plain sight. She shakes her phone to turn on its light and holds it out in front of her. Then she turns a slow circle, recording the crowd. I can't believe there's a club that celebrates Casanova. It's already creepy that anyone would admire him. But the thought of a pack of misguided men becoming organized and doing disturbing things on campus to terrorize women is worse. I wonder how far they would take things while drunk and celebrating. With Casanova gone, the campus is supposed to be safe for GU women again. I really hope it is. The roses aren't real, they're paper, Aria says, dipping the edge of the tissue paper into a candle. It catches fire instantly, and she drops it onto the wooden raft where it quickly becomes ash. That smell, Eden says, wrinkling her nose. What's the smell? The candles. They're rose-scented, Tavi says. The motherfucking balls, Aria says, spitting out the words. I'd like to junk punch whoever made this raft. She blows out the candles and then dumps the entire raft into a metal trash can. Hey, I say, moving closer. Are you guys going to the auditorium? Yes, Eden says. Could I walk with you? My friends decided to stay on the quad. Yeah, of course, Aria says, waving me closer. Join the sisterhood. I'm Tavi, Octavia says with a friendly smile. She's carrying her band hat and flute case, but shifts them under her left arm in order to extend her right hand to me. You're Declan Hayworth's new PA, right? I squeeze Tavi's hand in a makeshift shake as I nod. Oh shit, Aria whispers. Declan's new so-called PA? Eden, are you good? Eden's gaze of feigned boredom washes over us. Something wrong? I ask.
Eden dated Declan for over a year. With a small smirk, Arya adds, until things got too wild for him. She winks and puts a finger to her lips. Too wild for Declan? I can't even imagine what that would entail. Ari! Tavi exclaims and then says something to her in Spanish. Arya rolls her eyes. Anyway, Eden's and Declan's relationship wasn't just a college romance. It was almost a merger. The fams aren't happy about the breakup. I hear they've pushed a bill into the Senate to bring back arranged marriages so they can pump up their waspy bloodlines. Eden rolls her eyes, and to me she says, ignore her. What's your name, babe? Cameron. Or Cammy. I pause, glancing at the three beautiful girls. I feel like Tavi's welcome is sincere. With Arya, there's an edge. And Eden has that upper crust aloof thing going on. Are you sure you don't mind my walking with you? We definitely don't mind, Eden says, linking an arm through Tavi's. I'm open to new friendships. Declan's the one who may have a problem with our arriving together, not me. He would? Why? I wonder silently. Does he still have feelings for her? When Briggs sent me instructions on shopping and being styled, he mentioned Eden. The relationship must have been pretty serious at one time. Jealousy ripples through me. Like me, Eden is blonde and petite. But unlike me, she has the all-star athleticism and pedigree, perfect for Declan in every way. Stuffing my hand in my coat pocket, I find my phone buzzing persistently. I wonder whether it's Declan again. When my phone emerges, I glance quickly at it and see the text is from him. I feel a small sense of satisfaction that I'm the one he's texting from his VIP party. Unfortunately, the last words he sent are, looking for trouble? My mouth goes dry and my skin tingles. I know what that means. 15 minutes or more over his lap, squirming through a punishment that will leave me panting and wet, despite the horrible ache in my ass. Our relationship is so sordid. My heart knocks against my ribs. And I glance over at Eden and Arya, wondering whether I dare ask them more questions about Declan and the wild things he supposedly didn't want to do. It would be nice to confirm where his limits lie. My gaze drops to the back of Eden's skirt, as I wonder whether he spanked her, too. I doubt it. That seems like something he'd reserve for girls from less lofty backgrounds. It's probably why he wants me so much. I'm the kind of girl he thinks he can use in filthy ways that are unsuitable for girls of his own set. We arrive at the student center, and a few thousand people fill the main floor of the auditorium. A DJ is spinning, raising the party to a crazy pitch. As soon as the four of us approach the elevator to the VIP party, a whole group of people trails after us. A pair of campus police officers stand like ushers at a movie theater, blocking access to the elevators. Hey, Shane, Eden says. I thought I saw you. My head jerks to look over my shoulder. Shane Morin stands directly behind us, towering. Where did he come from? Was he following us for a while? I texted Declan to say Shane didn't need to fetch me, since I was on my way over and walking with a group. Apparently, Declan ignored my message, which is par for the course with him when he has a different plan. The campus security guards manning the checkpoint review our IDs and consult their list. The five of us are ushered past the black rope toward an open elevator car. The group of students behind us ask whether they can get a VIP invitation as members of the Hayworthies, since some of the fan club officers got added to the guest list at the last minute. Their request is denied, and the last I see of their disappointed faces is when the elevator door shuts. Upstairs, as we emerge, we have a bird's eye view of the auditorium floor, where sailing beach balls and waving glow sticks rule the night. I enter the VIP room and find it's actually a banquet hall with several hundred people inside. The furniture is super swank, with dark blue velvet couches and iridescent bronze pillows. Waiters circulate with trays of champagne, and there's a long food buffet with a large knight ice sculpture in the center. Wow. The people here include the city's mayor,
the university's dean, and the multimillionaire alumni sponsors. I spot the head of Ralston Enterprises in a GU sports coat with his trophy wife on his arm. There are also professors, football players and their families, and women in power suits and evening wear. Plus, a contingent of what seems to be Declan's official fan club. I recognize the women from his sidewalk. Tonight, the Hayworthy girls wear short pleated skirts and matching silky tops in bronze and silver. Each has a small, glittering face tattoo of Declan's number on her right cheek. Declan stands in the center of a crowd, smiling politely and talking casually with his legion of admirers. Grabbing a small plate, I head to the buffet because I'm starving. After I fill my dish, I find a tall table in the corner to station myself away from the main action. Shane and his girlfriend stroll over to me, and Avery gives me a warm smile. "Cameron, hey, how are you?" "Hungry, apparently," I say with a wink, dabbing the corner of my mouth with a GU napkin. Shane dips his head in my direction and asks if I'd like a drink from the bar. "I'll take a Dr. Pepper if they have it." "They do," Avery beams, holding up a soda with a lime wedge and a maraschino cherry floating in it. We smile at each other like we're members of an exclusive club. At GU, we sort of are. "I'll be right back," he says, moving away. We discuss the parade and celebration. She's a freshman, so we also discuss being new on campus and our respective fields of study. "I'd like to become an investigative journalist," I say, "but it's tough to break into." "You could ask Declan to help you. His family knows everyone." "Yeah, but I don't think Declan would be interested in doing that." Shane arrives with my soda at the same moment I hear Declan's voice behind me. "What am I not interested in doing?" As I turn to include him in our circle, my gaze rakes over him. He's over-the-top gorgeous in a dark suit and vibrant blue tie that matches his eyes. "Advancing my journalism career," I say. "You're right," he says. "In general, I'm not a fan of the media. Their whole mission these days seems to be to work people into a frenzy using hysterical editorializing." "Pass. In the old days, neutrality and objectivity were inherent to the job. Some of us believe it still is," I counter with a small pout. Shane holds out my drink, but Declan takes the soda before it reaches my hand. He sets it on the table next to us. "We'll be right back." Declan motions for me to come with him. Although he doesn't touch me, his hand hovers near my back, acting as an invisible tracking beam pulling me along. We circle the outer edge of the room, but Declan still has to stop several times to shake hands with people who approach him. He doesn't introduce me until someone asks who the lovely girl with him is. "My assistant, Cameron." The elderly man nods politely, but I notice an immediate difference in the way he looks at me. When the man thought I was Declan's girlfriend, the vibe was open and welcoming. Once I'm designated as an employee, the warmth drains away, and no more attention is paid to me. It definitely stings. When we reach the double doors, Declan pushes one open and motions for me to exit. Preceding him, I step out into the empty south hall. "This way, Cameron." I stroll after him, following him to a bathroom with navy-colored tile and bronze walls. It takes a moment for me to realize what he wants to do. "Declan," I say hesitantly, "people noticed us leave." "We were discreet enough." Declan's fingers flip the lock. "Face the mirror and put your hands on the sink." When I don't immediately move, he takes my hips and turns me. A hand smacks my ass, causing warmth to spread through it. "Later, we're going to have a conversation about doing what I say when I say to do it." Any words I might have said are frozen in my throat as his hand slides underneath my dress and stops at the underwear I wasn't supposed to wear. "There's just no end to the trouble you're going to get yourself into tonight, huh?" He leaves his mouth close to my ear and in a low voice says, "Lower these to your knees and bend forward." My hands linger on the sides of my dress, my fingertips grazing my skin but not reaching for the silky fabric Declan wants out of his way. "I'm not sure about doing this here," I whisper. "I am," he says in a husky voice. Deep in my core, simmering heat flares into a blaze. My mind wants to tell him off, but my body has its own agenda.
Declan's big hands take my wrists and set my hands on the sink. Hold on. My fingers grip the chilly porcelain. The snick of a zipper lowering causes my breath to catch. Are you wet for me? Before I have time to answer, his strong fingers jerk the fabric of my panties aside so he can check himself. A hint of a predatory smile appears. Our eyes meet in the mirror. One black brow rises slowly, and he cups the back of my neck with his free hand. It slides up the back of my head, and the glide of his fingers over my scalp sends shivers down my spine. Pushing my head forward to lower it, he says, "Keep your head bowed." My nipples pucker. He loves to feel like he owns me. There's a part of me that likes feeling branded as his too. Staring at my fingers gripping the edges of the sink, I rasp, "Declan, come on." The hand in my hair tightens, so it pulls at my scalp. That little threat sends a terrible dark thrill through me, making my core clench. "Behave yourself," he whispers, my lips part, letting a harsh breath escape. I shake my head a fraction, causing the tug on my hair to deepen. I try to raise my head, but at the first sign of my resistance, he pushes harder, bowing me farther over the sink. "Gonna try to fight, sweetness?" "No." Even as I say the word, though, I try again to lift my head. His hand moves from my scalp to the front of my throat, gripping me firmly. Our eyes meet again in the mirror, my face burning. "You want to look in my eyes while I fuck you? All right, trouble." The huskiness in his voice cuts right to the core of my lust. "You're already so far gone, you might as well go all in." Sapphire eyes challenge me as his thick cock pushes into me. An "oh" of surprise parts my lips, and my traitorous body stretches to accommodate him, loving the feel of him inside me. With one thrust, he pushes my hips against the sink and pins me. "Fuck, that feels good," he says. My lids drift down, and his grip on my throat tightens as he grinds against my ass, finding a rhythm. The sink cuts into my hips, increasing the sensation of being taken roughly from behind. I wasn't this girl until I became his. Waves of my hair brush against his muscled forearm as his thumb strokes my throat. His hand is so big, it wraps to the back of my neck, making me feel small and vulnerable. The impact of his powerful body trapping and using mine is like a battering ram. And I enjoy it more than I'll ever admit. His cock pounds continuously at something in my core that causes a primal need. My teeth sink into my lip. The persistent vibration of his phone causes my head to tilt. "That's not the kind of vibration we need right now." His voice is cool, but there's wry humor in his tone too. "I'm gonna come. No orgasm for you, it's part of your punishment." Honestly, I'm enjoying the feel of his urgency. "It's enough for now, but I don't say so." His head tips back and his breathing grows harsher. As the thrusts inside me become more forceful, they drag answering clenches from my body. A soft groan escapes his throat as I tighten around him. "Fuck, good girl." The warmth of his seed fills me, and his grip on my neck tightens until my breath is trapped in my lungs. My heart hammers. In this moment, he has complete control of my body, even my breathing. An instant later, his fingers release my throat and he pulls out and steps back. Before I've had a moment to recover, he jerks me around and kisses me. It's not soft and sweet. It's another form of claiming. But the ripples of its impact crash through me and I grip his sides, the soft, rich fabric of his suit coat crumpling in my fists. His mouth jerks away. "Siren." The kiss is too short to satisfy me. I want more of his mouth and rise on my toes. We kiss again, even more frantically, until he grips my upper arms and separates us. "No." Declan's voice is firm, and I get the sense he's talking to himself as much as to me. Taking a step back, he releases me and straightens up. "Fuck," he murmurs in a smoky voice. He puts his cock away and zips his trousers. My breathing remains choppy for longer. One of us is an elite athlete, the other is not. Wait a minute before you come back into the party. Without another word, he disappears from the bathroom. I relock the door and lean against it, catching my breath. I'm not sure how I feel about having sex in a public restroom during a formal event. Do I go with my body's reaction that this was a delicious dirty interlude? Or do I go with my reeling head that says Declan's taking the arrangement too far? After I put my appearance back to rights, I wash my hands and step out into the hall. There's a member of Declan's security team waiting for me. A knowing smile plays at the corners of his mouth. For fuck's sake. I look away, heat suffusing my cheeks. Yeah. It's official. Things with Declan have gone too far.
Chapter 27. Declan. Back in the VIP room, I feel energized. As happy as I am to celebrate our victory publicly, the illicit fuck makes me more so. Easy, I think. Focus. Arranging my features to hide my thoughts of her, I allow myself to be consumed by the crowds of well-wishers. In moments, I'm surrounded by boosters. I smile and shake hands as I'm introduced. Eden appears at my elbow and offers me a drink. With so much ibuprofen in my gut for my ankle, I'll tear up my stomach if I hit it with a lot of alcohol. I take the glass but won't drink much. My aunt, who's looking thin and morose tonight, materializes by my side. Eden, nice to see you. Typical. My family joins me only when they deem the company suitable. I'd roll my eyes, but I don't want it noted. Eden is game for a conversation with Aunt Lizzie, so I leave her to it, heading toward Shane, who's in another group. Out of the corner of my eye, I spot Cameron and notice her expression is dazed. This isn't the way she looked when I left her a few minutes ago. As she walks, she teeters like she's drunk. What the hell? I move closer. Did something happen to upset her? Is that why she looks so distracted? Yes. Something's wrong. Fuck, she's going to fall. I dart forward, banging past a waiter. In my wake, I hear glasses crash and shatter. She's going down. I grab for Cameron like a fumble, landing on a knee as I catch her and pull her into my body so she doesn't hit the ground. Her lids flutter and she stares blankly at the ceiling. Hey, can you hear me? I murmur sharply. Cameron. Her eyes roll back in their sockets, acknowledging nothing. Her breathing is slow and shallow. Jostling her doesn't restore consciousness. She's fainted, but it's more than that. Her lips look dusky and are turning darker by the second. Lowering her gently to the carpet, I lean forward. With my cheek above her lips, I check for breath as I feel for her pulse. Her heartbeat thumps under my fingertips, but she's barely breathing. Glancing up, I spot Sorensen. Eric, grab the doctor. He moves instantly. A second later, Shane elbows his way into the circle forming around us. Fainted? He asks, kneeling next to me. His fingers pry her lids open. Deck, he whispers, beckoning me to lean in. Pupils are pinpoint. For a second, my mind is blank, not understanding. She needs someone to breathe for her until we can get our hands on an antidote. I can do it, if you want. He starts to lean down, but my hand stops him. It takes a moment for my training in rescue breathing to come back. I position her head, noting that her lips are now dark blue. Pinching her nose, I put my mouth over hers and blow into it. Shane moves away quickly, and I concentrate on breathing life back into her body. Her mouth is slack under mine, as lifeless as the rest of her. My heart hammers in my chest. She's dying. It feels like hours before Shane returns, but then I hear his voice say, "Hang on, man." He puts his hand over her face, and I hear something spray. There's a plastic device concealed in his palm, so it's nearly invisible. Pushing him back, I give her another breath. And another. I'm afraid to stop. After a few moments, her body shudders back to life, sucking in air as her lids flutter open. Shane's voice is quiet but relieved. Here she comes. That's better. The team doctor and the trainer join us on the floor. Eric's deep baritone says, "Back up, give her air." I'm glad he's intervening as crowd control. This is the last thing that needs an audience.
What happened?
She rasps, her brows crinkled as she stares into my eyes.
You fainted. Everything's all right,
the physician says as he checks her blood pressure. Nodding, he smiles down at her. Shane has pocketed whatever he used to revive her and says nothing to dispel the notion that she passed out from natural rather than synthetic causes. We leave her lying down until she's able to sit herself up. Then I lift her to a standing position, keeping my arm around her so I can catch her if she starts to fall. It was a narcotic overdose, I realize. Tiny pupils. Respiratory failure. Next would have been death. We stopped it just in time. Leaning my head toward Shane's, I whisper under my breath, "Will she need more of what you gave her?"
"Maybe."
Shane reaches a hand toward her. "I can take her home with Avery and me so you can finish out the event." My eyes take in the room. People continue to glance over, but are starting to return to their conversations and celebrating. "I'm ready to go," I say. Shane's brows rise.
"You sure?"
"Yes." No one should begrudge me getting my personal assistant home when she's ill.
"What's this?"
Avery asks. Our heads turn toward her. In Avery's hand, there's a pink sticky note.
"Let me see," I say, peering down.
My hands are full, so I don't reach for it. Smoothing the crumpled edges, she holds it up. Printed in black marker are two words. Not Hayworthy. It hits me like being slammed to the turf during a sack. What the fuck?
"Where'd that come from, baby?"
Shane asks. In a tone grave enough for a cemetery, Avery answers,
"It was stuck to the back of Cammy's dress."
Son of a bitch.
Did a lunatic fan slip something to Cameron that almost killed her? Shane takes the note and pockets it as we head toward the door. Cameron is still woozy and incoherent, but I manage to steer her into the elevator. As soon as we're inside, I scoop her up. It'll be easier if I just carry her out to the car. Text my driver, "Shane, have him meet us in the parking garage." "Already done." Thank God Shane noticed the pinpoint pupils and realized it was an overdose. The trainer carries the antidote in his medical tackle box. With young athletes on pain pills, you never know when someone will pop too many. My driver waits next to the limousine and holds the door open for us as we approach. I climb in, still carrying her, and sit with her on my lap. By the time the car starts moving, Cameron's more alert.
"What happened to me?"
Glancing around, she tries to push off my chest so she's not leaning against it. My arm steadies her. She doesn't need to be curled against me like a kitten, but when she tries to move off my lap, I hold her in place.
"No.
Stay." It'll be easier to slide us out of the car when we arrive if she's already on my lap, or at least that's what I tell myself. The truth is, I'm not ready to let her go. The back of my shirt is damp with sweat from the adrenaline surge. I've never experienced fear that way before. She blinks, furrowing her brows.
"Did you take something?"
"One of my pain pills," I ask.
"No."
She murmurs as her eyes lose focus.
"Why would do it?"
"To get high."
Her frowning expression is confused.
"I don't even.
She rubs her head, causing several strands of hair to stand out at a 40-degree angle. "All right, just relax." My hand smooths down her hair.
"Who gave you your drink?"
Shane asks. Studying him for a moment like English isn't her first language, Cameron blows out a breath. Then, in a slightly slurred tone, she says,
"You did, right?"
"Did you leave it sitting alone?"
he asks.
I don't know.
"Yes," Avery interjects softly.
"It was on the table when Declan took you outside. It stayed there while we were talking to people."
Avery's expression turns pensive as she looks at Shane.
"Our backs were turned. We weren't watching."
He shrugs, his expression grim. "It's not an underground club, and she wasn't there alone. We didn't expect someone to Mickey a drink." "The note implies a crazed fan did it," I say, grinding my teeth at the thought. Shane's mouth forms a hard line. "Your fans are lunatics, man." Unbidden, my hand smooths down wisps of Cameron's hair again. "Hell is other people."
"That's for sure,"
she mumbles, and then slumps over, thumping my jaw with her skull as she lands against my chest.
"Nice," I murmur.
"I'm tired," she whispers, her lids drooping. My hand moves to rest against her side so I can make sure she keeps breathing. Shane's smirk causes me to roll my eyes, but I'm too relieved that she's all right to be bothered by anything. I'm gonna have to heighten security around us, I say. Seems like, Shane agrees. She can stay with us. We'll watch her, Avery says, which is an exact replay of Shane's reaction. What's up with these two? Why are they so ready to take in strays all of the sudden? No, she's mine. I'll take care of her. Shane gives me the side eye. She's my assistant and therefore my responsibility, I correct, glancing at Avery before returning my gaze to Shane. He, of course, knows better than to believe the assistant part, but he's smooth enough not to show skepticism. And I'm not exactly lying. Cameron is more of an employee than a girlfriend. We're not dating. I feel responsible for her well-being the way I'd feel responsible for Briggs if armed kidnappers stormed Hayworth House. I'm a target for robbery, kidnapping, and stalking. Since the people around me can become targets because of their proximity to me, my security team must prevent them from becoming collateral damage. Tonight, apparently none of them was watching Cameron closely enough. That will change now, because what happened tonight can never happen again.
Chapter 28. Cameron. There are vague moments of consciousness. Sitting on Declan's lap in the limo, being carried into the house, Briggs trying to get me to drink some tea. When the haze lifts enough for me to stay awake, I sit on the edge of the bed with a hand against my temple. I'm still wearing the dress I wore to the party. It's fitted and cuts into my sides uncomfortably. Briggs has left tea and pumpkin spice cookies on the bedside table. Declan watches me from an antique wingback chair he's brought into the room. He's still dressed in his suit trousers and shirt, but he's removed his suit coat and tie and unbuttoned his top button. As Declan explains in detail what happened, I start to cry. "I did not overdose," I exclaim when he asks me if I could have taken something accidentally. "I didn't take anything." "Okay," he says gently. "Someone drugged me. Almost killed me. I've never hurt anyone. I wasn't even publicly laying claim to the Hayworth Prince. I was just there drinking a soda and people watching, and someone tried to murder me." I've never felt more alone in my life. Declan moves to sit next to me on the edge of the bed and puts an arm on my shoulders. He's trying to comfort me, but it doesn't work. We're not in this together. No one is trying to kill him. They're trying to kill me because of him. When he falls silent before finishing the story of what happened, I push him to keep going. He explains how he and Shane saved my life. He points to a plastic naloxone nasal spray device that's standing on the nightstand. "Shane used one and gave me the other one from the box, just in case. I didn't need to use it. Your breathing has been fine." Wiping my eyes, I nod. "Thanks for taking care of me. But why didn't you take me to a hospital?" "We thought you might have taken something yourself. I knew the hospital would assume that. I didn't want it to go into your medical record." I stare at him. "I'm not going to be here long enough for this to come up again, but for the record, if I'm ever poisoned again, I want you to take me to the hospital. And I want someone to call the police." "The police," he says with a small grimace. "All right. But the GU campus police and even the local city police aren't equipped for major crimes. The Casanova case has proven that. Early on, evidence was improperly collected and contaminated. The FBI was not happy with Granthorpe or Foxgrove PD." Pursing my lips, I shake my head. "The local police are better than nothing. They should have been told so they could get my glass or whatever. Now it's too late." Declan remains silent. A small knock on the door causes us to look up. "Come in," Declan says. Briggs enters, carrying a steaming cup of tea. He replaces the cold one that's in the saucer with a tentative smile.
It's good to see you awake. Glad you're all right.
Thank you, I whisper. To Declan, Briggs says,
There are no fans left on the sidewalk, sir. Security has cleared the entire block. I sent an email to the Hayworthy's president about the incident tonight, with instructions that no more loitering near the house is allowed, and impromptu requests for autographs or uninvited approaches to the property are now unacceptable.
Good. Thanks for staying late, Briggs. You can head out.
All right. Good night, sir.
Good night, Miss Reynolds. After Briggs leaves, Declan glances at me with a concerned expression.
My family is so scandal-averse that it sometimes affects my decisions. I apologize for not involving the police. I didn't realize that's what you'd want.
Jesus. Declan lives in a whole other world where he doesn't count on the police for protection or investigations. His family probably talks directly to the FBI when they need something from law enforcement. And that probably doesn't happen often given their private security force.
Tomorrow, I'll call the Hayworth fan club officers and my teammates who are at the party to see if anyone noticed anything. Shane will talk to the people who were closest to where the drink was sitting. He and Avery made a list of who they talked to while their backs were turned to your drink.
I nod. To me, that sounds like a job for the police, but I don't say so. Maybe I'll go to the hospital for a drug test, I say, just so there's a record. And so I can know exactly which drug was used.
All right. I'll take you.
He sounds resigned rather than interested. I push his arm off my shoulders. You don't need to come. I can use a rideshare to get there. Standing, I glance around for my purse. Declan stands as well.
Don't be ridiculous.
If you're going out, we're going with you.
We? Me and my security detail.
Looking away, I grimace. I ditched Declan's private security and acted like I didn't want the guy hovering around. If I hadn't done that, would he have been close enough at the VIP party to see someone slip something into my drink? Blowing out a breath, I rub my forehead. Tears fill my eyes again. It's all too much. Declan scoops me up and sits on the bed with me on his lap. Wrapping his arms around me, he says, Come on. Don't cry. I almost died. The words leave me as a sob. I know, it was awful. His voice is low and grief-stricken in its own way. My eyes rise to steady his face. Were you worried? At the time?
Worry isn't the right word.
Afraid. He draws in a breath. I've never been in a situation that was so completely out of my control and where the stakes were so high. Aside from the moment when I realized my mom wouldn't be found alive, tonight was the worst thing I've ever experienced in my life. You were slipping away, and I wasn't sure I could keep you with me long enough to save you. His arms tighten around me. I know we've had arguments and that this is an unconventional arrangement. But when we're alone, the rapport is beyond what's typical for me. If you had died in my arms, I would not have forgiven myself. A tear spills over my lashes and I brush it away. Did he just admit there may be something deeper developing between us? He usually acts like I'm the only one at risk of catching feelings. What happened wasn't your fault, Declan. It wasn't, and it was. I didn't give you the drugs. But whoever did got away with it because I was determined to keep plenty of distance between us, for discretion's sake. If I'd kept you closer, the drugging wouldn't have happened.
Maybe, maybe not.
He shakes his head. My priority was to cover my tracks, which is why you were in a remote corner. I failed to keep an eye on you, even though there was no higher priority in that room. No higher priority. Your friends were there, Shane and Eric. My friends can take care of themselves. You came to the party because I insisted, he scowls. The one person other than myself who's my responsibility is the girl with whom I've just had sex. Before I can respond, his fingers slide into my hair to tug my head back so he can kiss me.
I'm sorry you got hurt, Cameron. Our tongues slide over each other. He tastes like liquor and soda. I swallow and inhale his breath as I melt against his body. I no longer feel alone.
Declan. Once we arrive in the emergency department, Cameron seems less sure of her decision to be here. I pay the copay and ask to speak to a senior physician.
What are you doing?
She whispers. Why do you want to talk to the head doctor? Your body is metabolizing the evidence as we speak. If there's going to be testing, let's do it. Otherwise, the drugs might be gone.
Oh. Yeah, that makes sense.
Licking her lips, she tilts her head.
If they don't find anything, they'll think I'm wasting their time.
It doesn't matter what they think. This is part of the job they're here to do. She nods and seems reassured.
Thanks.
I nod, and once we explain the reason for the visit, we're moved into a quick care area. A senior faculty member with long, fuzzy brown hair arrives to talk to Cameron. She asks me to step out into the hall. Cameron glances at the door, and then back at the physician.
Why does he have to go?
I'm surprised that she wants me with her. I'm also glad. I'm more than willing to advocate for her.
I'd like to talk to you alone first.
Is that all right with you? The doctor asks her.
Yes, but I'd like him to come back in after. I was unconscious. We'll need Declan to fill in the blanks.
Of course. The physician opens the door, and to me she says, "It'll only be a minute." I nod and step out. Once the door closes, I open my phone and start returning messages. There's always a backlog. Killing time, I finish off 12 threads while I wait. Then the door opens, and I'm beckoned back inside. I realize from the ongoing discussion that Cameron has declined a forensic rape examination. I hadn't even thought they might suggest it. It's a good thing she declined, since the exam might seem equivocal to an investigator. Cameron's certainly got signs of recent trauma from having sex with me, and the semen they'd find would be mine. A nurse comes in to collect Cameron's blood, and they explain they'll be doing both rapid on-site toxicology testing and a send-out tox exam for rarer substances. They'll also do a serum pregnancy test.
I'm not pregnant.
Cameron says quickly, her eyes darting to me.
I'm on the pill, and I never miss a dose.
It's just routine testing when a young woman faints. The doctor says with an encouraging smile as she leaves the room.
Yeah, and no form of birth control is 100% foolproof. The young nurse says kindly, "We've got to check."
She wraps a rubber tie around Cameron's small bicep. Cameron's other hand reaches out, coming to rest on the edge of the exam table near me. I set my hand next to hers, palm up, and she puts her hand on mine. I close my fingers around hers and squeeze as the needle goes in. Her lids drop, and she takes a deep breath as the syringes fill with blood.
"That's all, honey," the nurse says, removing the needle and putting a bandage over the puncture site.
She snaps the rubber tourniquet loose and gathers everything. Cameron nods.
"Barely felt it. Thank you."
Once the nurse is gone, Cameron slides her hand out of mine.
"I'm okay."
Leaning back in my chair, I fold my arms across my chest casually.
"I've taken my pill every day," she says. "In case you were worried."
"I wasn't worried. I trust you."
"Thanks,"
she says with a small smile as she rubs the side of her neck absently. I probably should be more concerned. I usually wear condoms regardless of whether a woman is using contraception. I skip the condom with Cameron. It wasn't a deeply considered decision. I just stopped. Somewhat reckless. It's always been impressed upon me that I need to guard against unplanned pregnancies, the preferred form of entrapment used by gold diggers for centuries. In private conversations, a couple of the men in my family encouraged me to stick with oral and anal sex during college. Brock was one of them. Which made me wonder whether he didn't want kids himself, and those were tactics he used to avoid it. Later, I learned he was never able to get my aunt pregnant because she has some disease of her reproductive organs. Eventually, it'll be up to me to carry on my grandfather's line. when I marry a suitable wife. That common refrain is something I don't think much about normally. It's a vague part of the future I'm not concentrating on yet. When the physician returns to the room with test results, Cameron reaches out her hands for the papers.
Not pregnant. Right? Correct. Not pregnant.
Thank God, Cameron says. Something about her obvious relief hits me sideways. It's odd to be with a woman who has zero designs or even interest in a future with me. Perversely, I almost point out that her kids could do worse, and probably will in the genetic lottery of mankind. But the impulse to speak up is ridiculous, and I suppress it. It's good that she sees our situation as temporary. That's exactly how I want her to see it.
Toxicology shows you have morphine in your system, the doctor says. You don't take any medication for pain?
None, Rin says.
Well, then, if that's the case, someone definitely drugged you.
Chapter 29. Cameron. Declan offers to take me to the police station to make a report, but I decide I'd rather wait. The hospital was enough for one night. When we get inside Hayworth House, I stop at the guest room door. Thanks for coming with me to the hospital. My fingers touch his arm fleetingly. Night, Declan. Reaching over my head, he pushes the door open. But when I step over the threshold, I realize he's following me. Turning, I put a palm against his chest. What are you doing? Invite me in. The huskiness to his voice gives me a clear indication of what he wants. I glance up at him, surprised he'd suggest this now. You don't really want to sleep alone, do you? He presses. Pausing, I think it over. No. But I'm not sure I'm up for what you have in mind. I don't want to leave you. His voice is gentle, unusual for him. It's the sincerity in his tone that gets me. I move aside so he can come into the guest room. He removes the extra chair, setting it out in the hall. Instead of getting ready for bed, I stand near the chest of drawers, deciding not to think too deeply about where things are headed. As he undresses, my gaze drops to his groin, where there seems to be an outline of an erection. He removes his boxer briefs, and his cock springs free, confirming that he's already hard. You are completely shameless, I murmur with a small smile. I think sex will make us feel better. In more ways than one. His tone is serious and sincere. Also, whoever drugged you doesn't want us to be together. This is my way of saying fuck you to that person. It's another clever argument that works as he intends. Someone really doesn't want me to have him. And I won't. Not for long. But for now, I can have him as often as I want. No jealous fan can stop me. Can I ask for something? I say. Of course. I'll give you anything you want. Blinking up at him, I realize he thinks I want him to buy me something. And his response is spoken like a man who has more money than God. I exhale a small, amused sigh. If I want to stop, can I do that without it leading to a fight or punishment? I ask. Yes. His gaze lingers on my face. You can stop things here and now if you want. No, I whisper. I just need to know. I don't know. My lips are dry. I lick them and bite the lower one. That you're safe? You are. He turns me and lowers the dress's zipper. Within seconds, he's pulled it from my body, and I'm left in a peach bralette and panties. His hungry eyes consume my exposed flesh. Your beautiful skin gets me every time. His thumb strokes my shoulder as my stomach clenches. It's impossible to not love the way he looks at me. Declan picks me up and sets me on the bed so I'm lying down. Sliding arms under my body, he moves me so my head is on a pillow near the headboard. I have a flash of being carried, with my head tucked against his chest. Murmurs of other people as we pass. He carried me out of the party.
Someone in that crowd saw him rescue me from their vicious plan. Good. Fuck them. From the nightstand, Declan takes out a small bottle of lubricant. He spreads some on his cock and the fingers of his right hand. What are you doing?
I know you're sore. I'm going to make sure there's as little friction as possible.
The bed sags under his weight as he kneels between my knees. Lowering himself onto his left palm, he slides his right hand between my lower lips and rubs slippery gel over my entrance. Then his fingers slide down to swirl around my asshole. Declan,
you'll like having my fingers there, he says confidently. Trust me.
My stomach knots, and I'm afraid he might be right. When he had his thumb inside it, I came so hard. I feel his cock's thick head at my entrance. Biting down on my lip, I brace myself. There's no pain as he enters me. There's only a dull ache as I'm stretched around him. Exhaling a long breath, my hips twist. You feel big. As usual. Too much, he asks. Not sure. I don't think so, I whisper. Licking my lips, I nod for him to continue. With a slow thrust, he seats himself all the way inside me, forcing my walls apart to make room for him, which feels good. His cock bumps my womb, sending a contraction through my belly. Oh God, you're so deep.
Always, he whispers,
lowering his face so his lips are just above mine.
No rules tonight. Kiss me as much as you want. Ask for anything.
Staring up into his sapphire eyes, I nod slowly. Then I kiss him softly, and he answers in just the same way. We taste and touch with our tongues. It's slow and sweet. His hips move in small pulses, grinding his flesh against my clit. I shift, tipping my pelvis to increase the pressure and to make it easier for his cock to drive into my body.
Does it feel good?
He asks. So good, I gasp. I like when you go slow at first and then...
What?
Our eyes lock and he kisses me again. Then you get the way you get. Rougher. My hands slide up to caress his shoulders. Should I do something? Move against you more?
For me or yourself?
Either.
Don't worry about me. I always get exactly what I need from you. Concentrate on yourself and follow your instincts. Your body will tell you.
Circling my hips, I find the right position. Oh, God, right there. I groan. Please, more right there. His strokes turn more forceful, and I feel them through my whole body. His hands grip my ass and pull me up to meet him. Cool fingers coated with gel swirl around my asshole, and one pushes inside. Oh, God, I husk. Careful, please. He teases me there, slowly. The finger partially withdraws and then sinks back in. Primal sensations spark and combine with the tingling in my clit, which is rubbing against him. My body likes when pressure and penetration come from so many directions. The burning need builds in my core as arousal drills into me from so many stretched places. Oh God, please don't stop. His thrusts turn more aggressive, reverberating through me until I feel it in my ribs and throat. Until my insides scream from the friction. It's hard to take, but it also feels good when he hits the deepest part of me. His weight shifts, some more of it rides my body. Being used like this feels so forbidden and so good at the same time. My teeth sink into my lower lip and I moan. That seems to drive him harder until the bed creaks under the strain.
Feels right, doesn't it?
He demands. I'm incoherent with lust, and the sounds I make are ragged moans from deep in my chest. The rhythm shifts again, until he's pumping so hard and fast that our bodies make a slapping sound, and I feel the heat building in my ass. A second finger sinks into my tight hole and stretches it. A horrible, delicious penetration that I can't resist any longer. Waves of pleasure propagate from the places he's stretched open for his use. My body shudders in the grips of an intense orgasm. Above me, he strains, driving so deep it makes my belly cramp. He groans, and then the pulses turn sharp and staccato. He's coming too. and the power of that feels remarkable. This shared orgasm is dark and potent and all-consuming. His breathing is harsh and gives way to a raspy curse. Then he whispers something in French. Clinging to his body, I whisper, "Say that again in words I can understand." His lips press against my throat, leaving a trail of kisses. My fingers play with the damp hair at the base of his neck. No rules, right? Just for tonight, you can tell me anything. He raises his head to look at me, and our gazes lock. "There's a raw connection between us now that I haven't felt before," I said. He drags in a breath and licks his lips. "Nothing compares to you." Incomparable. Yes, love that. The whole experience leads to a natural high. I fall asleep in Declan's arms, content. After sleeping soundly for hours, I wake around dawn, smiling. Then I realize I'm alone in bed. A little sigh escapes. I understand why Declan never sleeps with me. He doesn't want me to get too attached or to develop expectations beyond the agreement. But right now, his leaving bugs me. A no rules night should have meant we could break the rule about not sleeping together. We did that in South Carolina when I wasn't recovering from being poisoned. I search for my phone to send him a snarky meme that will express my displeasure at the way he bailed from the bed. Unfortunately, the device is nowhere to be found. After climbing out from under the covers, I check the room and my purse. Nothing. I ventured to the kitchen and front room. But there's still no sign of my phone. I wonder if I could have dropped it somewhere. My stomach plummets. I cannot afford a new one. Thinking back, I'm sure I had it in my purse at the hospital. I don't think I left it there. Another possibility occurs to me. With a sharp glance at the stairs, I frown. Did Declan take it upstairs with him? He might have decided he should answer texts for me while I slept. But I'd rather leave people hanging than have him rummaging around my phone. Any guy would know that. Except maybe one who thinks normal rules don't apply to him. I jog up the curved staircase, sliding my hand along the intricately carved wood banister. On the upper floor, there's more hand-carved wood everywhere. Stopping to admire an inlaid panel that depicts a medieval hunt, I wonder what it would be like to live in a house that was passed down over generations. I'm passionate about history, so I'd love that. I head down the dark hall and come to a wood door that is inlaid with a pair of cameo heads, with Caesar haircuts and crowns. It's amazing and also over the top. Seriously, who lived here? Napoleon? Smothering a chuckle, I shake my head. If these ancient coin-headed dudes are on the door to Declan's bedroom, I am going to tease him for it mercilessly. Attempting to turn the antique brass knob reveals that the door is locked, of course. Because even when we're alone in his house, the prince needs to keep his peasant concubine from barging in on him. I tap on the door.